if nothing else, our discussion of quantum theory so far has equipped you for understanding this afternoon's colloquium. This is your chance to go to a colloquium and understand everything that's said, which is a real treat for some of us. Okay, let's push on to the next topic, and I want to start out by introducing a piece of operator machinery that I may have mentioned before, but I want to sort of go ahead and make sure that we all understand it, and that's the trace of an operator. The trace of an operator. The trace of an operator is a scalar. The trace of an operator is a scalar. So how does the trace work? What do you do to take a trace? Well, it's actually a really simple thing. The trace is a really simple idea. There are two parts to the idea. The first part is that the trace takes an outer product to an inner product. That is to say, the trace of some outer product of a ket with a bra is simply the inner product. And notice the things that started out as kets stay kets, and the things that started out as bras stay bra. And then this is what happens. That's what a trace does. That's what a trace does. And the second thing is that the trace operation is linear in its argument. And since every operator can be written as a sum of outer products, this tells you exactly what the trace does to all operators. Now, of course, you could certainly think of traces this way, and this is a really nice way of thinking about it. And the thing I like about this is that this definition is obviously independent of any choice of basis. Okay? Obviously independent of choice of basis. But let's suppose you have a choice of basis. Let's suppose you have a basis of some states, we'll call them n. And then that will allow me to write an operator, as you know, as the sum, a double sum over m and n, of some matrix elements times the outer product of m with n. And that matrix, those matrix elements are themselves given by the inner product of m with a n. Okay, so we could write the operator in this way always. So then what's the trace of A? Well, the trace of A will be equal to, all you do is you go into, you look at this sum. This is the sum of a bunch of things times outer products. You just turn all those outer products into inner products. So this is the sum over M and N of A sub M N times the inner product of N with M. But of course, this is an orthonormal basis, so that inner product is the Kronecker delta. In the usual way, we use the Kronecker delta to do one of our sums and turn all of the m's into n's, for example. And we get the sum over n of a sub n n. Oh, yeah. This is actually just the sum of the diagonal components of the matrix representation. It's the matrix trace of the matrix representation. It's the matrix trace. So the concept of trace, or spur, sometimes it's called, used in a matrix, is the same concept as the trace of an operator, but it doesn't depend on your choice of basis. You see, if I'd chosen a different basis, I'd have all these different matrix elements. I have a completely different looking matrix. But it turns out that its trace is exactly the same, a fact that looks mysterious until you realize that both of those things are just implementing this prescription. Okay, so One important property of the trace that I would like to mention is the so-called cyclic property of the trace. And that says that the trace of AB is equal to the trace of BA. And that's pretty easy to show. It's pretty easy to show. Just put in some bases, and it basically amounts to the fact that complex numbers commute in multiplication. But be careful. Beware. This is not the arbitrary permutation property of the trace. The trace of, say, RST, well, that's equal to the trace of, that's equal to the trace of STR. What did I do? Well, I just had two operators. One of them's R, the other one's ST, and I moved the R to the end. But this is not in general equal to the trace of SRT. I can't get this order of matrices by taking something off the beginning here and putting it at the end here. So this is not a warrant to arbitrarily rearrange operators in your traces. But it is a warrant to take something off the beginning and stick it on the end. Okay? Inside a trace. Okay, so there we go. So much for the trace. That turns out to be a really handy thing today. Now, what I want to do is I want to begin talking about the very important question, what happens if we cannot assign a definite state vector to a system? What happens if we cannot assign a definite state vector to a system? We have a system. We want to do quantum mechanics on the system. We want to make quantum mechanical inferences about the behavior of the system. But we just don't have the ability to assign a definite state vector. Why might that be? Well, there are two particular situations that I want to mention. One of them is what we might call a mixture. And this is a situation in which we're just ignorant of the details of the quantum system. We might be fairly confident that there is a state vector. We just don't know what it is. It was generated perhaps randomly or according to some factors we don't know about. For example, we might think that there's a definite quantum state for the trillion atoms in a cubic inch of aluminum. About a trillion atoms in a cubic inch of aluminum. We might think there's a definite quantum state, but we just don't know what it is. So, in fact, what we would have is a probabilistic, what's called a probabilistic mixture of states. And this is something very different from a superposition. There's no coherences here. This is just something's random. The state psi alpha might occur with probability p sub alpha. So we might know this much. We might have this probability may simply reflect our opinion. If you take a Bayesian view of probability, that's all probability really is. Anyway, and each of the possibilities here corresponds to a particular state vector. And these guys, by the way, need not be orthogonal. I don't necessarily know that the state is one of a set of basis states. I don't know that. So that's one possibility. You might have a statistical mixture, not a superposition, but a probabilistic mixture of different pure states. That's one possibility. The other possibility is much more fundamental. We might think that, well, this is just our problem. But there's another problem. There's another situation which is much more fundamental. And that's when we have entanglement. Um, suppose we're looking at a subsystem of a system in an entangled state. An entangled global state, psi. The whole thing about an entangled state is that if you have an entangled state of the whole system, you cannot assign state vectors to the subsystems. They don't have definite state vectors. If they had definite state vectors, it'd be a product state. So in either of these cases, we won't be able to assign a definite state vector to a system. We'll have to do something else. And I want to talk about this, and the easy thing to do is to talk about mixtures. And then later on, show you that you can handle the entanglement situation in exactly the same way. But we're going to talk about mixtures for most of today. That's our basis. Our not orthonormal Hilbert space basis, but that's the basis for our discussion. Okay, so if I think about a mixture, one way to think about a mixture is to think about an ensemble. An ensemble, what's an ensemble? You used that word before? What I imagine is I have a very large number of systems, okay? A very large number of systems, and they're similar kinds of systems. And each of them has some definite state, but I'm going to draw my system. I'm going to draw at random from this box of systems and do my experiment on it. So there's a fraction p sub alpha of the ensemble that are in the state psi sub alpha. And there are many, many systems. Okay, many, many systems. And so some fraction of them, some ensemble is in the state psi 1, and some other sub-ensemble is in the state psi 2, and so on. And the fraction in the ensemble corresponds to these probabilities that I had here. And now let's suppose that I take systems from the ensemble, and maybe I do this a whole bunch of times so that I can do statistics, and I make a measurement of some observable A. And what I want to know is the ensemble average. The ensemble average for that A. So we have an ensemble average A. Now this includes two things. This average, it includes the fact that different systems here are prepared in different states. But it also includes the fact that for a given state, you might have various values of A, because those states are not necessarily eigenstates of A. And so what this is going to be is it's going to be the sum over alpha of the probability of alpha, the fraction in the ensemble, times the expectation value, quantum expectation value of A, if you're in the state alpha. By which I mean, of course, the sum over alpha, P alpha, and then there's the matrix element, psi alpha, A, psi alpha. Okay? So now I'm going to say I have an inner product here, and so I'm going to use the trace. The trace takes an outer product and turns it into an inner product, so I can imagine that that inner product is the trace of an outer product. So I can write this as the sum over alpha p alpha times the trace of the projection onto psi alpha times A. But now I note that the trace is linear. The trace is linear. See, I'm really using my essential ideas about the trace directly here, and I get that this whole thing is the trace of, and I'll collect together all the things that depend on this index alpha. So the ensemble average of A is the trace of an operator, this operator in parentheses, an operator that depends on the mixture but not the observable, times the observable. See, I split things out into, this is something one likes to do. One likes to, if something depends on both the mixture and the observable you're doing, it's neat if you can split those two dependencies out into separate pieces. And here they are. There's this thing and this thing. And so, this is our inspiration to define the density operator often the Greek letter rho, and I make my rows this way, which may be a little backwards, but that's how I do it, sorry. But often some other letter. Actually, there's whole branches of physics literature in which they use W for density operators. So anyway, the density operator is the it's this thing. It's the sum over alpha, p alpha projection onto psi alpha. It's the, if you will, the average of the projections. It's the average of the projections onto the various possible states in the mixture. And then, this density operator is pretty cool. It means that this ensemble average is the trace of rho times A. Rho depends on what mixture you have. And A is just your observable. So it's a really neat little formula. It could hardly be neater. And if we have something like this, we say that this is, this describes a mixture of states, or we say that it describes a mixed state. A mixed state, which can be described by a density operator to distinguish it from the kind of states that can be described by a state vector. Those are called pure states. Pure states. So, versus pure state. Of course, if there was only one term here, we could also write down a density operator. But okay, let's talk about properties of the density operator. Let's just write a whole bunch of them down. Let's see. Rho is Hermitian. It's the real sum, real coefficients times a bunch of Hermitian operators. So rho's Hermitian. That's kind of cool. In fact, rho's even better than Hermitian. Rho is actually something called a positive operator. If you have a Hermitian operator, it might also be a positive operator. And a positive operator is this. For any vector psi, psi rho psi is greater than or equal to 0. Now, why is that true? Well, it's really easy to see. Phi rho phi is just equal to the sum over alpha, p alpha, I'm going to take the sum out, of phi psi sub alpha, phi. Oh, yeah, but I recognize this guy as the magnitude of phi psi sub alpha squared. And so this is the average of a bunch of numbers that can't be negative. So it's greater than or equal to 0. So this is this requirement right here, or this property right here, says that rho is a positive operator. I use the term positive to mean what is sometimes called positive semi-definite. The semi-definite means that this could be equal to 0. If it was positive definite, that would mean that this is strictly greater than 0 for any non-zero phi. Okay? So when I use the word positive, I mean positive semi-definite, if you want to be careful about it. Okay? Let's apply the trace operation to the to the density operator. What's that? Well, let's see. That's a sum over alpha, p alpha, times the trace of this outer product, which is just the inner product. Of course, these are normalized states, so these guys are all 1. It's the sum of a bunch of probabilities. What's the sum of a bunch of all the probabilities? 1, right. So the trace of the density operator is 1. These are, in fact, the 3 key properties of the density operator. It's a Hermitian operator. In fact, it's positive, which actually implies Hermitian, so 2 key properties. It's a positive operator, and its trace is 1. What else? Oh, well, I just gave you one, so let's, that the ensemble average of any observable is just the trace of rho times A. That's a wonderful thing. So what that means is that if I have a mixture, if I have a mixed state, the density operator allows me to make all the predictions of all the expectation values of all the observables, and that includes all the probabilities of various outcomes and all the powers of all the observables and so on. The density operator is a complete statistical description of the results of experiments on this system. Okay? It tells me everything. It tells me everything. For a pure state, yeah, for a pure state. Let's do that. For a pure state, a state that could be described by a state vector, then I would have a mixture in which all the probabilities are 0 except one of them, which is 1. And so rho is equal to just the projection operator. Yeah? If you diagonalize it, the entries are all 1. But it is this in every basis. I'm sorry, it's 1, they're all 0 except one of them, which is 1, right? But this relation is independent of basis. It might not be easy to recognize if you wrote this in terms of some basis. You might have really complicated matrix elements. We'll talk about what the matrix density, the matrix representation of the density operator looks like. But this is true. This is not basis dependent at all. There's something wonderful about this, by the way. This is just a projection onto the state. Remember how the state psi and the state e to the I phi times psi are really sort of the same physically? Does it ever bother you? You say, well, how come I have more state vectors than I need? Right? I have multiple vectors in my vector space that correspond to the same physical state. That's kind of ugly. These two correspond to exactly the same density operator. Because when I take that outer product, I'll get e to the I phi and e to the minus I phi, which will be 1. So the point I'm trying to make is that the density operator is, in some sense, really it's got more of a one-to-one map between density operators and physical situations. Okay, we don't use density operators in everyday quantum mechanics. Often because state vectors are just simpler. They have fewer components, for one thing, right? But then if state vector has d components, the density operator has d squared components. D and d squared, that's maybe a big deal. And also because the principle of superposition, the linearity of the structure of quantum mechanics, is a lot easier to see when you talk about state vectors than when you talk about density operators. But the point is that there is something very deeply right about a density operator. Okay, let's see, what else can we do? I should tell you, there's a mixture rule. If you have, this tells me that this is actually a mixture of density operators, right? It's actually a probabilistic combination of density operators. And that's a general thing. So let's suppose we have density operator row 1. That's the mixed state. That's the particular density operator. And that's with probability P1 and row 2 with probability P2, et cetera. Then the density operator describing that whole mixture, and these might refer to sub-ensembles to which I would ascribe a certain density operator, is just P1 times row 1 plus P2 times row 2, and so on. That is to say, it's the sum over alpha, P alpha, row alpha. And in these expressions, my handwriting challenge is always to make sure I can tell the difference between my P's and my rows. Okay? And you should take on that challenge as well. I know you're too old for me to tell you about handwriting, but this is one of those cases where it can be a problem. Yeah?
These rows are not correspond to pure space.
They might not. They might not. They might. And so if they do, then you have this rule. It's the same as this. But if they don't, it might just mean that suppose I divide the ensemble into pieces, and this ensemble is described by a mixed state, row 1, and the fraction of the systems that are in that are P1. And this ensemble is different, and so on. Then the whole ensemble is described by this this combination, probabilistic combination. Now, I have to tell you that different ensemble, or different mixtures rather, can lead to the same density operator. Different mixtures might same density operator. It's not that all mixtures lead to the same density operator, but different mixtures might lead to the same row. And let me give you an example, a simple example. Okay, my example, I've got a qubit. Okay, and in mixture number 1, I have the state 0 with a probability of 0 equal to 1/2, and the state 1 with probability of 1 equal to 1/2. Okay? Yeah. I'm considering the density operator description of a situation in which there is some definite pure state which was prepared by a process that I don't know completely. So when I'm talking about mixtures, I'm automatically assuming that there is a fact of the matter which I just don't happen to know. Okay? However, the same density operator description will also cover other situations. Yeah, that's important. Right. You said, I prepared it in a pure state, but I'm not telling you which one. I'm only going to tell you the distribution that I drew this pure state from. And so, yes, exactly. And the reason is merely convenience, because I can easily develop all the properties of the density operator, and then I can show that the same description will apply in the other situation. Yeah, okay. So, what's the density operator here? It's 1/2 the projection onto this plus 1/2 the projection onto that. Oh, yeah. That's just 1/2 times the identity. But you know, that only relies on the fact that these guys formed a basis for the qubit Hilbert space. I could have another mixture, number 2, where I had a different basis, say the plus minus basis. Which occur with probability p plus equal to 1/2 and p minus equal to 1/2. And then the same density operator would arise. So in one of them, let's say these are I'm talking about spin states. In one of them, I prepared the system in a z component of angular momentum, spin up or spin down with equal likelihood. That's one situation. I describe it by a density operator. The other situation is I prepared it spin to the right plus in the x direction, spin to the left plus minus in the x direction with equal likelihood. And I would describe that mixture with the same density operator. Each of them is 1/2 times the identity on the space. And so I would conclude from that that these two mixtures would lead to exactly the same ensemble averages in any experiment. These two mixtures would be statistically indistinguishable. If you had a process that created this mixture and a process that created that mixture, they each create the same mixed state, the same density operator, although the recipe for creating it is different. Okay, so far so good. Things seem to be going well. What are other things that that states do? Well, one important thing that states do is they evolve in time. So let's talk about the time evolution of a density operator. And let's fall back on the ensemble picture. What I imagine is that all of these systems in the ensemble evolve according to the same dynamics. They're a bunch of dynamically independent systems with identical Hamiltonians, and so they just evolve the same way. They evolve the same way. And so that means that what I'm going to do is I'm going to imagine that each of these pure states evolves according to the same dynamics. So for example, psi alpha of 0, if this is the state early on, that will evolve to psi alpha of t, which will be some unitary operator, psi alpha of 0. Some unitary operator, which depends on time, depends on the elapsed time. So what does that mean for that? That means that rho of t, which is the sum over alpha, p alpha, psi alpha of t, it's the mixture of these states at the time t, why that's equal to the mixture of those states evolved from time equal to 0. U dagger, of course, because to get the evolution of the ket, I use U, but to get the evolution of the bra, I have to use U dagger. Oh, and I can just take this sum inside that operator product, and I get the following relation that rho of t is equal to U rho 0 U dagger. So unitary time evolution of a density operator is pretty simple. The unitary operator appears twice, at the beginning and with its Hermitian conjugate at the end. But it's very nice. The time evolution works out pretty well. Of course, I can ask the question, what about instantaneous time evolution? What about the equation of motion? The Schrodinger equation, what does the Schrodinger equation say? Well, the Schrodinger equation says that the derivative with respect to time of any one of these psi alphas is 1 over I h bar times h psi alpha. That's the Schrodinger equation, right? That's the Schrodinger equation. So what's the derivative of rho with respect to time? Well, we're assuming that all of these guys are evolving independently. And what that means is that the fractions of the ensemble associated with index alpha don't change. The p alphas don't change. So this is going to be the sum over alpha, p alpha. And then I'm going to have the time derivative of this. But of course, the time derivative of this outer product will involve two terms. There's going to be the derivative with respect to time of the ket psi times the bra psi plus the ket psi times the derivative with respect to time of the bra. And I'm running into my other part of the board. Okay. Oh, but now I can write this, of course, as 1 over I h bar times h psi alpha. And this guy is minus 1 over I h bar bra psi alpha h. The minus sign, of course, comes because I have to take the Hermitian conjugate. And all the i's go to minus I. And so this becomes the sum over alpha p alpha, and I'm going to have h times the projection onto psi alpha minus the projection onto psi alpha h, and I can take the sum over alpha into here because h doesn't depend on alpha, and so I can write down the Schrodinger equation for a density operator. And that is that the derivative of rho with respect to time is equal to 1 over I h bar times the commutator h rho. Now, this may remind you of something like the Heisenberg equation of motion for an observable or something. But there's something wrong with it. What's wrong? Yeah, in that one, the commutator was in the opposite order. Why is that? Well, there's a little. This is a trivial exercise, but it's fun and it helps you get the hang of this density operator business. So let me work this incredibly simple exercise. Let's imagine that I had an observable. We're working in the Schrodinger picture, though, so I'm not going to jump to the Heisenberg picture. We have an observable A, which is a constant over time. It doesn't have any intrinsic time dependence. And let's find out what the derivative with respect to time of the expectation of A is. Of course, that's the derivative with respect to time of the trace. But the trace is linear. The derivative operator goes inside. And so this becomes the trace of the derivative of rho with respect to time times A. Okay? Now, we can now use our Schrodinger equation to write down what that derivative is. That's equal to 1 over I h bar times the trace of the commutator of h with rho times A, which is equal to 1 over I h bar. There are going to be two terms here, and I'll separate them out. There's the trace of h rho a, and then I subtract off the trace of rho h a. Okay? Everybody happy? Now I can play the cyclic property of the trace game, a very useful game indeed. And I can take this h and move it to the end, so I have rho at the beginning of everything. And so I get 1 over I h bar times the trace of rho a h, minus rho h a. Oh, okay, right? Which is 1 over I h bar times the trace of rho commutator of a with h. And now you see that a appears first in the commutator. And I can write that as 1 over I h bar times a kind of expectation value of this commutator. Because this is the trace of rho times an operator. And that's exactly That's exactly the equation we had before for the time evolution of an expectation value of an observable. It also this still works for density operators, and you can see that the trick for obtaining that is the cyclic property of the trace. Okay. Questions. All right. Let me continue by talking about a matrix representation of a density operator. Because very often, when you're doing calculations, of course, you're not just dealing with the abstract operator that lives out in Neverland. You're dealing with a particular representation of it. So we have a matrix representation. And once again, all I mean is the matrix you get when you pick a basis in the Hilbert space. I don't mean some kind of group theoretic idea. Matrix representation for rho with respect to the basis n. Okay? And of course, what I'll have is I'll have a bunch of guys rho m n, which will be inner products like this. These will be the elements of the matrix. Elements of what's called the density matrix. And in fact, if you go back to old-fashioned sorts of things like von Neumann's book from the 30s, in which he introduced what we're calling the density operator, he calls it a density matrix. Operator is a matrix, is an operator is a matrix. So this is the density matrix. What does that look like? What does that look like? Well, let's see. It's a matrix, so it's a big square array of numbers. And there's some entries along the diagonal, and there's some stuff off the diagonal. So what are the diagonal entries? What are the diagonal entries? Diagonal entries. Well, rho in is equal to in rho n. What is that? This is the probability that you would get the result in if you used this basis to do a measurement. You can work it out. This is the probability that you would actually get the result in. The probability of in a measurement of this basis. Okay? And so the things along the diagonal are sort of probabilities. They have a particular name. They have a special name. The diagonal entries are called populations. And the idea is to go back to the ensemble picture. To go back to the ensemble picture, this reflects how many members of the ensemble would be found in this state if we made this measurement. But of course, even if this were a pure state, there may be several of these which are not zero. Well, what's the difference between a superposition of these basis states and just a mixture of the basis states with these probabilities? What's the difference? The difference is not in the populations. The difference lies off the diagonal. Off the diagonal. The difference between mixtures and superpositions can be found off the diagonal. And so the off-diagonal elements are called coherences. Coherences. Okay? The off-diagonal elements are called coherences. And so that's the anatomy of a density matrix. Populations on the diagonal, coherences off the diagonal. I'm introducing this terminology without without giving you a lot of extra baggage about it. But those are useful names to know. Questions? Yes.
About the density operator in the Heisenberg picture?
Sure. Think about the basic thing that we started with, that the expectation is equal to the trace of rho times A. Okay? And let's see how that evolves in time. Well, that says that that this is the trace, this is a function of time, is the trace of u, some initial rho, u dagger, times a. Okay? But the cyclic property of the trace permits me to write this as the trace of rho dagger times u dagger a u. Okay? The cyclic property of the trace allows me to write it this way. Therefore, I could imagine this to be my timeless state here, and this to be my time dependent operator observable, and then I would find that this is always equal to the trace of that in that picture as well. So the cyclic property of the trace is the thing that justifies the Heisenberg picture for density operators. You now move all the time dependence from the density operator to the observable. Okay? Yes?
So, it's going to be
another
question. So, doesn't the matrix representation really depend on the basis of choice?
Yes.
Is there any preferred basis of choice?
As usual in choosing bases, nothing. Our choice of basis is a choice of convenience. I mean, if there's some particular measurement that we're going to perform, then it's nice to choose that basis for your representation, because then you can just read off the probabilities of the outcomes off the diagonal. But aside from that, well, even that's just, it's just a property of convenience. We get to choose any basis we like to describe the world, so choose wisely. Okay? Some bases are more convenient than others, but the basic facts of nature shouldn't depend on what basis we choose to represent our matrix, our operators as matrices.
How do you know that
the
limits of sense
don't work? Oh, well, if you have a pure state, okay? If you have a pure state, and that pure state happens to be one of the basis elements, then all of this will be one with zeros everyplace else. There'll be a one on the diagonal someplace, and then there'll be zeros everywhere. But if it's if that pure state happens to be a superposition of your various basis elements, then this other basis, you'll have all of these things being non-zero. So in one of them, you have no coherences because you only have one population that's non-zero. In the other one, you have populations and coherences like crazy. The distinction between populations and coherences is entirely basis dependent. It's not about something fundamental about the density operator itself. It's simply a way of anatomizing this matrix and discussing it. Maybe that in some bases, there's some particularly nice thing happening with the populations of the coherences. That may be true, but the basis is our choice. Basis is our choice. Other questions? Okay. Yes?
Okay, so the density operator is an observable because it's Hermitian.
It's an observable because it's Hermitian. That's kind of funny. There is an observable which is numerically equal to the density operator at a particular time, but I don't have a density operator measuring machine. Okay? Let's see. The word observable connotes the existence, at least potential existence, of a measurement procedure that that might reveal one of the eigenvalues of that thing. So I think that it's safe to say that every observable is a Hermitian operator, but is it useful to think of every Hermitian operator as an observable?
Because whatever.
So this is state dependent. This is a state dependent observable. What does that mean?
Because what I really wanted to ask is if we were to write the Heisenberg equation for rho.
The Heisenberg equation. Oh, right. See, that's one place where you can really see that it's not quite right. This is the equation of motion for rho. In the Heisenberg picture, rho is time independent. It describes the state of the system. In the Heisenberg picture, rho is just the initial rho. Okay? So in the Heisenberg picture, the rho, whatever it is, whether or not it commutes with Hamiltonian, rho is constant. So the density operator does get treated differently from all these other things which correspond to measurement procedures.
Okay, so I don't want to see it as an observable.
Okay, think about it this way. We're using Hermitian operators now to describe both measurement procedures and preparation procedures. The density operator really encodes information about the preparation of the system. Okay? And in some sense, those occur kind of at opposite ends of the experiment. Okay? We prepared it, then we measured it later. Okay? They're playing a sort of a dual role with each other. For the density operator formalism, we use operators to describe both of those. So maybe that's the few words there. Other questions? Okay. It turns out that for qubit systems, spin 1/2 or a 2L/m or something, there's a really slick way of thinking about the density operator for that system. A really slick way. And so I want to introduce you to the really slick way for thinking about density operators for qubit systems. But before I do, I have to point out a little something about mathematics, which is lovely. And that is, if you're given a Hilbert space with dimension D, so everything I say will be confined to finite dimensional Hilbert space, though it can be extended with suitable caveats to some infinite dimensional spaces, then there's something called B of H, okay? And it's called B because in infinite dimensional space, that B stands for bounded. But finite dimensional space, everything's bounded. These are the operators. This is the set of operators on H. Okay? It's the set of operators on H. And the really cool thing about it is, it's a Hilbert space, too. The operators themselves form a Hilbert space. So if I have the sum of two operators, or I multiply operators by a scalar, yes, it's still an operator, right? So it's clearly a vector space. And the dimension of that vector space is what? Well, it's D squared, because I'm going to need a matrix, a D by D matrix, to represent my operator, right? If I only need D numbers to describe a vector, I'm going to need D times D numbers to describe an operator. So it's a bigger space, yeah? Ah, very good question. The inner product to use is this one. The inner product of two operators, the inner product of A with B, is equal to the trace of A dagger B. And it's not hard to show that this has all the properties of an inner product. That is to say, it's linear in the second place. The same norm as the operator norm? No. Yes. No. Yes.
I don't know. No, I don't think so. No, because the operator norm looks at the greatest eigenvalue. This is a combination of all of them. This is an L2 norm, not an L1 or not an L infinity norm.
Yeah, I mean, all the topologies are equivalent, right? But the great thing about this is, it's not just a norm, it's an inner product.
A much nicer thing. Much better. Hilbert spaces are nicer than Bonner spaces.
So this acts as an inner product. It's positive definite, it's conjugate linear in the first place, it's linear in the second place. It's just a great inner product. So we can talk about operators being, first of all, linearly independent of each other. That's the statement about being in the statement about this vector space. We also talk about operators being orthogonal to each other. Yes.
Can we continue this indefinitely?
Yep. Yes. So we can talk about what are these things that map operators to operators? They're called super operators. Yes, they live in a Hilbert space of their own. B of B of H. Rinse and repeat. The super operators are interesting. I don't really know of any use for super operators, but you know. Okay, so all right. So the reason I mention this is
to tell you that for a qubit. For a qubit, so that that's the dimension of the Hilbert space equals 2. Here's a basis for B of H. Here's a lovely basis for B of H. It's called the Pauli basis. Yeah. Okay. The Pauli basis, and it consists of four operators. The first one is the identity, and then the three Pauli operators, with respect to whatever basis you want. These guys form a basis. Okay? That's pretty cool. How do I know they form a basis? That's interesting. They're orthogonal, but they're not normalized. I've normalized them to 2 rather than to 1. It's just more convenient that way. They're orthogonal, but they're not normalized. Quite. But they're orthogonal. How do I know that? Suppose I take the product of 2 of them. Well, there are some things about the Pauli operators you ought to know. One of them is that the square of any Pauli operator is the identity. That the trace of the identity is the dimension of the space, which in our case is 2. The trace of any of the Pauli operators is 0. Because the trace, of course, if you look at the diagonal representation, the trace is the sum of the eigenvalues. The Pauli operators have eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1. And the Pauli operators have some nice algebraic combinations, which can be summed up this way. Xy is equal to minus yx, which is equal to iz, and cyclic. If we cyclically permute x, y, and z, then the corresponding things hold. So when I take products of the Pauli operators, then I get Pauli operators, maybe some factors of I. Okay. So if you use these things to work it out, and of course these things are all Hermitian. If I work out traces of products of these things. The trace of a product of this with itself is 2, this with itself 2, this with itself 2, this with itself 2, but the trace of any product of them is the trace of a Pauli operator, product of distinct ones, and it's 0. So they are orthogonal to each other. And they're not quite normalized, the norm, square norm is 2. So I can multiply them by 1 over the square root of 2. But that's sort of a council of perfection, and we'll ignore it. Okay. So since these are an operator basis, I could write any density operator whatsoever. I could write any density operator whatsoever as a sum of these guys. So let me do that. Rho is equal to, well, in fact, it's there's an overall factor of 1/2. Well, this is that's a totally inadequate piece of chalk. Okay, someone dropped that piece of chalk sometime like that. Okay. I'm gonna put an overall factor of 1/2 out here. That basically takes care of the fact that I didn't normalize properly. 1 plus AXX plus AYY plus AZZ. Now, my components of the operator are 1/2, 1/2 A, 1/2 Y, and 1/2 Z, or 1/2 AX, 1/2 AY, 1/2 AZ. Those are the components. Now, why did I put 1/2, and why don't I have anything here? The reason is that the trace of this has to be 1. The trace of the density operator is 1. That was just the sum of the probabilities of the mixture. And so that means that since this is the only thing that has non-zero trace, when I take the trace of this, the coefficient of 1 had better be 1/2. And it's just convenient to make the 1/2 multiply all of them. Okay, so I can write this in a neater way by saying that this is 1/2 times the identity plus a three-dimensional vector A dotted into the Pauli, vector sigma. Sigma, remember, is a formal vector that has components x, y, and z. But this is so slick, I can't resist venturing into abstract formalism. And so, instead of having a density operator, I can think of the density operator as the vector A. The vector A is called the block vector. A block vector for the density operator. And various properties of the density operator, properties of A. For example, A, by the way, is a 3D vector. It's easy to visualize. Well, now wait a second. There might be a problem. What if these are complex numbers? Because these might be complex numbers, might they? Could these be complex numbers? Could these be imaginary? Could they have imaginary parts? No. Why not? Because rho is Hermitian, and all these guys are Hermitian. Therefore, this has to be a real combination of them. And so this is not just a 3D vector. It's a 3D real vector. And that's nice. The real vector, the real part comes from the fact that rho dagger is equal to rho. Okay, that's really great, because I can visualize 3D vectors. I've been doing it since I was dandled on my mother's knee, since I was a wee bairn. We know that this works out that the trace is equal to 1. So one of the interesting cases is, what if rho is equal to sigma? I mean, it's not sigma. What if rho is equal to projection onto psi? What if rho is equal to projection onto psi, a pure state? What happens when that's the case? Well, one of the things that happens when that's the case, rho is a projection. And the properties of the key property of a projection is when you square a projection, when you multiply projection times itself, what do you get? The projection, the same projection. So that means that rho squared is also equal to the same thing. Well, what does that mean? That means that the trace of rho squared is equal to 1. So this is a property that must be true. This is a property that must be true for any pure state. Must be true for any pure state. Well, let's work this out using the block vector representation. So rho squared is going to be 1/4 times identity plus a dot sigma times 1 plus, not identity, a dot sigma. No, identity plus a dot sigma. I said it right. Okay. So this is what rho squared is going to be. And the trace is going to be 1/4 times the trace of this product. Now, there are 16 terms in that product. Right? Because each of these is a four-term sum. So there are 16 terms in that product. But in those 16 terms, my claim is that only 4 of them are non-zero. Why? Well, let's see. 4 of them are the identity. There's going to be x squared and y squared and z squared times the squares of their components. Those will have non-zero trace. But the rest of them will be products of the Pauli matrices or Pauli operators with the identity or with each other, with distinct Pauli operators. And all such things have zero trace. Only 4 terms survive. And actually, that's just another way of saying that that the inner product, which you can really think of this as one of these inner products, if you have an orthogonal basis, then the off-diagonal elements of that sum will go away. You just have the diagonal sum. But okay, anyway, so what am I going to get? Well, I'm going to get 1/4 times the trace of the identity plus the identity times ax squared plus the identity times ay squared plus the identity times az squared. The trace of the identity times 1 plus ax squared plus ay squared plus az squared, which is equal to, let's see, the trace of, this is just a numerical factor, the trace of the identity is 2, so I get 1/2 times 1 plus the inner product of a with itself, and that had better be equal to 1 for a pure state. That had better be equal to 1 for a pure state. Okay, so what does that tell me about the dot product of A with itself? Tells me it's 1. This tells me that the block vector is a unit vector for a pure state. Okay, that means that I can envision the set of pure states as being the unit sphere. What I haven't proven that any vector like this gives me a pure state, but that's also true. Not too hard to prove. Leave it to you for an exercise. That means I can envision the set of pure states as a sphere in three-dimensional space. Now, the pure states are really on the unit sphere in two complex dimensions. However, I have to somehow identify things that differ only by a phase. Okay? But what is that? That turns out to be just exactly a sphere of radius 1 called the Bloch sphere. And here's the z-axis and the x-axis and the y-axis. and the radius of this guy is 1. So radius equal to 1. And the pure states are points associated with vectors on the Bloch sphere. On the Bloch sphere. Well, where are they? Where are they? Which points are which things? Well, let's take the North Pole. Let's look at the North Pole. The place where the positive z-axis intersects the Bloch sphere. This is where A is equal to, component-wise, 0, 0, 1. And that means that that rho is equal to 1 half times the identity plus z. The identity plus z. Okay, well, let's write each of those in terms of the 0, 1 basis. The identity is the outer product of 0 plus the outer product of 1. Z is the outer product of 0 minus the outer product of 1. Oh, yeah. So this means that the pure state at the top here, I'm going to plant a flag at the North Pole here, that's right there, that's the state of 0. That's the plus and the spin up, if you will. Spin up, if you will. What about the South Pole? What about the South Pole? Here we're doing Arctic exploration here on the Bloch sphere. What about the South Pole? When we plant our flag at the South Pole, what does it say? Well, I can actually just figure it out just by looking here, right? That would be a minus sign here, right? And that means that this would be minus and that would be plus. Oh, yeah. So that means that this would have to be, that would have to be 1, which luckily looks the same right side up and upside down. okay, so, all right, so what this tells me is some cool things. It tells me, for example, that the z eigenstates are along the z axis of the Bloch sphere on antipodal points, opposite points, orthogonal states in the Hilbert space, opposite points on the Bloch sphere. Okay? And the same thing's true for the x-axis. Nothing special about the z-direction. If I did the same thing with the east pole over here. Have any of you read Winnie the Pooh? Right? They go off to seek the east pole, don't they? Right? Okay. All right. So we're gonna follow Pooh and find the east pole here. I'm going to plant our flag. Unfortunately, this won't be quite so rotationally invariant. In the x direction, the positive x direction, we'd find the positive eigenstate of x component of spin, which in case of 0 and 1, I sometimes call plus and minus, because this is 0 plus 1. So this is plus plus. And over here on the opposite side, my flag would read minus minus. And then I'd have similar things for the y direction. There'd be some i's though, so I don't have a cute little single symbol representation for those. But they'd be the projections onto the eigenstates of plus and the eigenstates of spin component of the y direction with plus and minus eigenvalues. Okay, so the Bloch sphere is kind of cool. This whole sphere corresponds to the pure states of a qubit. But wait, there's more. At least there was more when I was thinking about this earlier today. Yeah?
When you multiply those two brackets, cross terms go.
When I multiply these guys up, where do the cross terms go?
Yeah.
When I multiply these two Where are the cross terms going to be? The cross terms all have trace zero. Because the cross terms are all things like the identity times x, or the identity of y something, which is x or y, zero. Or something like x times y, which is I times z, trace zero. So these are the only, it's the trace that fills the other 12 terms. Okay. They actually exist in this product, but the trace is zero. Okay, well let's suppose we have a mixture of two states on the Bloch sphere. Let's suppose we have a mixture. Okay, we've got row one, which might be a pure state, with probability P1, and we got row two with probability P2, and so my overall row is P1, row one, plus P2, row 2. Well, what's that look like in a Bloch sphere kind of representation? Well, let's see. This is P1 times 1 half the identity plus A1 dotted into sigma, plus P2 times 1 half times the identity plus A2 dotted into sigma. Now, this is, it's not hard to see these P's go inside the one factor of 1 half. And that the terms that involve the identity just add up to the identity. P1 times the identity plus P2 times the identity is equal to the identity plus P1 plus P2 is 1. P2 equals 1. So where does that lead us? Well, it leads us to 1 half times the identity plus P1A1 plus P2A2, that vector dotted into sigma. So that tells us that the Bloch vector associated with this mixture, the Bloch vector associated with this mixture is P1 times A1 plus P2 times A2, the kind of average of A1 and A2. What does that look like geometrically? Well, what it looks like geometrically is, let's see, I've got A1 here, and I've got A2 here. It's on the line joining them. Somewhere on the line joining them is A. Which means that this A is in the interior. If these are different states, so I'm going to wind up with a mixture of states, A is in the interior of the Bloch sphere. So mixed states are in the interior of the Bloch sphere. They are states for which A dot A is less than 1. And so it's not just the sphere, it's the whole ball that has meaning. It's the whole ball that has meaning. The Bloch ball. I regret to say that it's still called the Bloch sphere in common parlance, even though we really mean the whole ball. The Bloch sphere on the outside and the interior. In the interior. So we have pure states on the outside, and mixed states on the inside. Suppose we look at the very center point. What's at the center of the Bloch ball? The zero Bloch vector. What density operator is it? The density operator, I've erased what it is, of course. It's 1 half the identity plus A dot sigma. If A is equal to 0, this means that rho is just 1 half times the identity. And that's sometimes called the maximally mixed state, or the uniform density operator on the space, or something like this.
That's the most mixed state right there in the middle. But everything in the block sphere is okay. Everything is a trace one positive operator. Suppose you tried to get away with a block vector that was outside the block sphere. It would still be a trace one operator. It would still be Hermitian. What would be the problem?
It wouldn't be a positive operator. It would be an operator
with negative eigenvalues, which in some measurement would predict a negative probability of some result. No. So here there'd be nothing. Pure states, mixed states. Now, are there similar, really slick, easy to picture ways of handling the density operators for higher dimensions? 3, 4, 5, 6. The answer is no. This is a lovely volume with a nice boundary that's defined by a single algebraic relation, and that's not true in any higher dimension. And so, sorry. They look kind of the corresponding thing you can write down, but it looks kind of weird, and also it's in a lot more dimensions. Yes.
I remember seeing something that the two-qubit case can be seen as a monopole, a Hopf vibration.
Right. That's right. You can because there are two qubits involved. So what you really need is some kind of structure on this.
That takes care of the two qubits. The two qubits, if they're in a pure entangled state, you can look at a special Schmidt basis that tells you something about this. But that's later. Okay. So. Yeah.
You said that the point in the middle is like the maximally mixed state.
Yeah.
Yes. So can you like give some kind of a measure for being mixed? Thinking about, if you like take all the convex combinations that give the same point,
mm-hmm.
and if you like imagine that there are lines, so you can move the line around, then it will paint a volume of the sphere, right?
Sure.
So if you compare that to the volume of the entire sphere, would that give some kind of a measure for being mixed?
Well, actually, anything in the interior is on lines that pass through every point of the exterior. So that particular suggestion might not work out without a little refinement. Okay. However, you can measures of mixedness, and there are many, amount to measuring how far you are from the center. One good way of looking at it is what's the trace of rho squared. For something that is that's something that is actually between, it's less than or equal to 1 and greater than or equal to 1 over the dimension of the space, is this for the maximally mixed state, is this for pure states, and so this gives you a way of measuring mixedness, for example, and that actually just corresponds to how far you are from the center in the block sphere. Any other questions? I'm gonna stop there. Question?
What? Well, it might be like a longer question. I can
ask. No. Well, ask it, and then if I have to, I'll brush it off.
We did these experiments that I never fully understood in my undergrad in the lab,
yeah.
Where we had ensembles of spins, you know, and we did things with them. And does this? So there somehow a block sphere was involved, which at the time
yes.
I also didn't understand very well. Right now, the experiment, for example? Yeah, we had a QIP experiment.
Sure, right.
And, like, they're all the same, right? So does this mean if I have an ensemble of spins, I can just think of it as one spin which points in the A direction?
Right. It'll point in some direction. It's often the case that that's a fairly small vector. But of course, when you're doing an NMR experiment, as we'll see, I hope to talk about NMR by the end of the course, and as you'll see, the signals that you get are proportional not only to the length of that vector, but also the size of your sample. So the actual things you measure in the laboratory, the ensemble helps. It gives you a good signal. So these states for individual spins, if you can assign the state would be a block vector.
So even if it's more than 2 qubits. Like, so you just said something like this is only valid.
If you're talking about experiments related to, so you have a molecule, okay? And you have an ensemble of molecules, and they're chloroform molecules. And the chloroform molecules have three chlorines and a carbon and a proton, a hydrogen nucleus. And you're just looking at the hydrogen nuclei in this, okay? There are other spins involved. But if you are only looking at the hydrogen nuclei, which you might do if you're only looking at the radio signals of the frequency of the precessing proton, then the measurements you're making are all measurements only about the state of the proton. And so only the density operator for the proton matters. However, you might do more sophisticated experiments where you're measuring more things, and more things are important. And then you have to take into account the fact that it's not just a qubit system, it's a bigger composite system that interacts with each other. But you're just looking at expectation values of observables for one of the spins, and you have a whole bunch of systems that are all similar systems. They're all chloroform molecules. They all have a proton. The protons are sort of your ensemble of protons. Then you can think of it as being something like this. Okay. All right. See you later.